views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio. Get ready to rid yourself of all that is weighing you down and holding you back from living the life you envision. Coming Clean, The Art of Transparency with Catherine Moss is a hit show that brings a real and dynamic message to uncovering and believing in the true amazing being you already are. For the next hour, Catherine will help you become truthful, authentic, and mindful of living on purpose one day at a time. Now here's your host, Catherine Moss.
Welcome to Coming Clean Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Arzimas. Stay with us for the next hour and let us help you experience the art of transparency. So I'm really interested in this idea of transparency and living in a way of being totally transparent. It really means not hiding or trying to be something that we're not. It's feeling, you know, pride in who we are and letting ourselves be seen for all that we are. So this is what I've decided to do ever since I got sober 3 years ago. It's been a journey since then, and it's often been quite bumpy, but it's, you know, living honestly and living truthfully really feels great. So each week on Coming Clean, I invite a guest on the show to share their unique truth and their authentic message and whatever it means to them of coming clean. And I'm really excited about manifesting this positive change in our lives and just, you know, freeing ourselves from anything that's weighing us down or holding us back from the way that we really, really want to live. So I invite you to start to live on purpose one day at a time. So as I've mentioned briefly on the last two episodes, I am a recovering addict. Alcohol and food were my drugs of choice that started at a very young age for me. I was pretty much obsessed with junk food, even as a child, and I loved the way that it made me feel inside. I blacked out at the first time I drank at the age of 14, and things really did not get much better after that. So that became the way that I coped with fear and resentment that I felt inside ever since a very young age. So this worked the way that I was living. It worked until it didn't anymore. My life was just really completely out of control. So from one moment of clarity, I became sober, and I'm happy to be living on purpose and in my truth today. I've read and heard many people talk about their stories from addiction to recovery, and they never fail to, you know, kind of tug at my heartstrings, really, and get me emotional. But unfortunately, not everybody gets there. I believe that recovery and sobriety is truly a gift. And for me, these stories are always incredibly intimate and beautiful. So the recovery story really is the tale of triumph of the human spirit. That being said, today I'm pleased to welcome Paul Krause to the show. Paul Krause is a personal development consultant, writer, speaker, and photographer based in Kyoto, Japan. Welcome to the show.
Well, hello, Catherine. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show. I'm honored. And yeehaw.
I'm excited to have you on. You know, for everyone listening, I met Paul recently. My husband and I were traveling around Asia. We went to Japan and China, and we were in Tokyo, and then spent, unfortunately, only a few days in Kyoto, and we met at a CrossFit. Randomly.
CrossFit gym. Yes.
CrossFit gym that my husband had dragged me to. And yeah, it was really great. And Torsten was like, tell him about your show. And I was all shy. I'm like, and then you ended up being, you know, a very interesting person. I was like, I want him on my show.
So we bonded over burpees.
Yeah. So, You've been in.
Go ahead, please.
You've been in Japan for a long time. right?
Almost, so over 21 years, yes.
What's it like living in Japan?
What's it like living in Japan?
I have to ask that.
Okay, well, being an expat, how can I say this? Actually, one of the biggest things that's different here is, I mean, I'm originally from the United States, from a place called Grand Rapids, Michigan. I used to be a daily newspaper photographer there for about 7 years. Along the way, I sobered out. And when I sobered out, I realized I didn't want to live in that town anymore. I wanted to see the world. And then I came to Japan. What's it like living in Japan? I'm 6'5", so everything's really small. Smash my head on the doorway a lot.
Do people want to take photos with you all the time?
Sometimes, actually. It's usually like junior high school students on a school trip, and they're like, take a picture with me. And it's fine. And then I just hassle them about their English. And because I used to be an English teacher, so I try to interact with the young people, and that's great. What's it like living in Japan? Actually, one of the biggest things that's different in my life is that I don't have a car. This in Japan I live in urban Japan, so it's I use the public transit system. I mean, it seems like a regular a weird thing, but just not having to. With the newspaper business, one of my jobs was to drive really fast to cover a traffic accident, and that got to be, you know, when you see what happens in traffic accidents, you know, day in and day out, I was getting a little wigged out there for a while, because it was like it's not if but when. It's probability. I was getting a little too stressed out with driving. So the lifestyle here of being a pedestrian and riding a mountain bike everywhere suits me fine. It's actually an interesting question. What's it like living in Japan? Living in a foreign culture is, I mean, you're living in Switzerland now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's pluses and minuses of living in a foreign culture. I rather like it. I like sort of the international feel. Where I live is relatively international in Kyoto. Kyoto's a famous international tourist destination. So it's kind of nice living in a place where people spend thousands of dollars to come visit, and I'm just like sitting down having coffee. I like living here. I've learned a lot living here. One of the greatest things I actually learned about, which doesn't really suitable for a radio show, is that it's oftentimes shutting up is a really good thing. Japanese people are quite quiet. Well, it can be quiet or talkative, but where I'm an American, and so we like to talk a lot and always give our opinion, but sometimes that's not always the best course of action. Just shutting up sometimes is a great thing.
So do you mean like small talk? If someone would be
not just small, you know, small talk. Well, for example, a simple thing like at dinner time, you know, it's perfectly fine not to talk, just to eat. To focus your attention on the food. So in the States, if a husband and wife are not talking at dinner, everybody's like, ooh, something's going on here between those two. Whereas here, we're just eating. Or just when some people always want to give their opinion all the time, it's like some people are talking just to hear themselves as opposed to listening to what the conversation is, for example, and inputting at an appropriate time or not. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question at all.
It's really interesting. You know, I really, really loved Kyoto. I think we were traveling for a month, and I have to say that Kyoto was definitely a highlight. We stayed at the, is it called Shunkoin? Is that what
Shunkoin? Yes.
Shunkoin. Reverend Taka. That was a really interesting experience. And we rode our bikes around, as everyone does in Kyoto. And I don't normally feel comfortable riding a bike in a city.
Okay.
And I felt totally comfortable. It was just so much fun. And there was so much to see.
Yeah.
So if anyone listening is interested in, you know, visiting Japan or visiting Kyoto, go.
The best times to go are May. After the first week in May is this, it's called Golden Week. It's a national holiday and it's super busy. But after that, the next 3 weeks of May, it's really nice. It's springtime. The flowers are out in the gardens and the weather's beautiful. Also, October is a similar kind of weather. It's where it's warm and not humid during the daytime and cool at night, because summer is the oven. It's like Louisiana. So. Okay. Hot and humid and sticky and gooey.
So you're originally from Michigan, you said?
Yeah, from Grand Rapids, Michigan,
Grand Rapids. So did you go from Michigan to Japan?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I would like to hear, like, that story, you know, from coming, you know, growing up in Michigan, your life in Michigan, and then how you made the choice to go all the way across the world.
Overseas. Well, yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to add that I read on your blog, mm-hmm. Which is paulkraus.com, well, paulkraus.com or Too Tall Paul.
Yes. TooTallPaul.com. That's right. TooTallPaul.com. Operators are not standing by. Yeah, nobody gets my name spelling right. Krause with a C, by the way. Okay. Go ahead.
You wrote a post called Life, Death, and Choosing to Be Awake, mm-hmm. which was very insightful. And it was basically about your story, right?
Mm-hmm. The whole story.
You have about 2 decades of sobriety.
Yes, from August 25th, 1991, is first day I was sober. Haven't had a drink since.
So when did alcohol and drugs start to become, like, what are your first memories of when did it start to become, like, playing a significant role in your life?
Well, I grew up in suburban Grand Rapids, which was a middle-sized town in Midwestern United States in the 1970s. It was, you know, it was sort of the 60s was the flowering, you know, the hippie flower power breaking of the old stereotypes. And the 70s was sort of this decadent decade where, all of my friends' houses, the parents all had, you know, cocktails and smoked cigarettes all the time. Seriously. It was like on the TV show it used to be. I remember seeing this guy named Dick, these celebrities on TV with a cocktail, you know, they're mm-hmm. wasted on TV with a cocktail, smoking cigarettes and telling jokes. That's the way it used to be. So when I was in high school, in this suburban high school, which I didn't really feel I fit in very well, this is what people did. We had like drinking parties. And so, I smoked pot when I was 13 years old on a YMCA canoe trip into Canada. These older guys I was on this YMCA trip and we're in the middle of the boondocks. And since I was quite young, the leader kind of kept me close, but there were these older guys there and, you know, we're in this lake and totally in the middle of nowhere. It was so far in the boondocks that you could dip your cup in the water and drink the water and it was good. But these guys said, "Hey man, you want a party?" And they showed me how to smoke weed when I was 13. By the time I was 14, I was the youngest of four kids. My oldest brother, two oldest brothers, you know, would go out at drinking parties. And that's what all the other kids did. It's, you know, parents would go away for a couple of days and the house would get invaded by, you know, a bunch of teenagers, you know, getting wasted off their parents' expensive scotch or trying to get, try to buy bottles of, you know, beer. Usually we had to go down the hood or something. The suburban kids go into the, you know, the inner city neighborhood buying beer because the local places wouldn't sell them to them. But we always mm-hmm. were able to find something. So it was often, so it was really part of the culture of people drinking and smoking weed and whatever else was available at that time. Mostly it was booze and weed, sometimes mm-hmm. Shrooms or whatever. Mm-hmm. So when I was junior in high school, my father got it was in the early 80s and the economy was bad. My father got a job in this little town in northern Wisconsin. And the drinking culture there was just cranked up a couple notches.
Where in Wisconsin was that?
It's a little town called Shawano. I'm gonna probably go into the northern Wisconsin accent if I start talking this way, you know. It's on Highway 29, halfway between Green Bay and Wausau there, you know.
Yeah, did I tell you that, like, I spend a lot of time in Wausau, Wisconsin? That's where my dad grew up.
Okay. Well, you know, Wausau is a big city there compared to Shawano. Anyway, well, it's like Wisconsin. There's like a beer on every bar, a tavern on every street corner.
Oh, yeah.
18. When I was in Michigan growing, it was 21. But in Wisconsin, it was 18. And I'm a big guy. And I, you know, my the hair on my face came out earlier than some of the other guys. So I was always the guy who had to go in to try to buy the beer. And they were like, you know, so in Wisconsin, in Michigan, it was like, you know, trying to get a six pack of beer between three guys. And in Wisconsin, it was like, okay, we got a case. And that'd be half the night was just trying to get the beer. In Wisconsin, it's like, we got a case of beer between two guys. What are we going to do for the rest of the night? So it'd be like these drinking parties out in the woods or whatever. There was a really heavy drinking culture. I mean, we'd go into some people's houses and they'd have two refrigerators, one for the food and one for the keg. And it would have like a spigot sticking out. And you go to someone's house, you know, I was 15 years old or whatever. And, you know, the mom would be like, oh, Paul, would you like a beer? You know, that's polite. So, you know,
so there really was no way around it, like socially.
For the most part, yeah, you're correct. Some people didn't, but a lot of times, if you want to have a social life, there wasn't a whole lot else to do in a small town either. Just get drunk and, you know, chase girls. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily catch them, but
yeah.
So we drank heavily there, and I started going to school. I went to school for 2.5 years at the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse, and this place was even more so with the drinking. There was I don't know if you ever heard of this brand of beer called Old Style. Mm-hmm, it's really popular in Chicago. Well, the company headquarters was in La Crosse, and they had the brewery right there. It was one of the largest breweries in the world, and the beer was dirt cheap. All the other beer companies were trying to sell their beer in La Crosse, so we'd get like a six-pack of Tallboy cans or like, I don't know, half a liter in each can, and we'd get that for like $2. And so we were like, the alcohol was cheap and everybody was drinking all the time. So my alcoholism kind of cranked up a few. That was, well, the university level of drinking culture there. And we would, you know, the parties would be pretty nuts. They had this thing in La Crosse called Oktoberfest. And it was this like week-long just massive binge of alcohol drinking by everybody, not just the college kids. Pretty much everybody was drunk all the time.
Yeah. And it's hard to like have a measurement of how, you know, your own behavior when everyone around you is doing the same thing, right?
Exactly. So falling down drunk and vomiting on the street was, you know, not a big deal. Other people did it all the time. But somewhere along the line, then for a couple of years, I transferred school to Madison, which is the Big Ten school, you know, the major state university. And so La Crosse was a smaller state university, and this is like, you know, big time school. And I started working for the daily student newspaper there. And somewhere along the line, whilst I was in La Crosse, drinking was like fun and a good time, and you know, party, where somewhere when I was going to school at Madison, I crossed this line, crossed the Rubicon from it being fun, party to this sitting home by myself, getting wasted and going into these dark places. I mean, I still had my fun out with friends, but I was drinking almost every day and delving into these just dark recesses.
And you were a college student still at the time.
I was a college student, and in my family there was issues with alcohol, with some of my family members, and you know, so I had that going on, and it was a way of dealing with things that, you know, my emotions, and there was some darkness inside of me that I didn't really know about, and this is the way I was dealing with them, and I didn't want to feel. You know, we're not really taught how to deal with feelings very well, especially men. You know, if you're having a dark feeling or whatever, what do you do with it? Well, let's get drunk. Mm-hmm, I don't want to feel that. Let's avoid it, or let's smoke a bowl, or. Mm-hmm. And I got really good with that combination of how much. When to smoke the weed, so I have the perfect oblivion, right? But I was a function drunk. Oh, go ahead.
Were you at the time that you said that you started to go into not so social drinking? Yeah. Were you conscious of maybe that, like, you know, like, oh, this things are changing and this maybe isn't normal?
I think I probably, I don't know if it was that it wasn't normal, but that it was. it was going into more of a funk. I was getting a different part of my life, and I was being much more serious about stuff. And just the whole party, that you can't last.
Yeah.
So there was this one bar we used to go to. It was called the Black Bear Lounge. I used to work in this college newspaper, and literally the house I lived in, it was the shortest route was to going through the back door of the bar, through the front door of the bar to get to my office. And sometimes just didn't make it to the office, or we would, after work, we'd go into we'd go to this bar, but it was really literally a dark place. I was a photographer. I started out as a photographer, and so I actually brought my light meter in there, and it was actually darker in the bar than it was in my darkroom.
Wow.
And that was, you know, sitting around, you know, these kind of, you know, morbid people sitting around the bar just getting obliterated, you know, sort of. I don't know if you can imagine the image in your head, but this, yeah.
Like divey, home yes. Wally type places.
Yep. Yes. Mm-hmm. And being in Wisconsin, there's like a gazillion of them, but yeah, this yeah. that hanging on the wall, and you know, in Madison Moore is more of a cerebral town in regards to the kind of type of people that were there. Mm-hmm. You know, some people, it's like delving into morbid, I want to say morbid, that's not the right word, but like some people are really into like these European philosophers and stuff, or they'd listen yeah. to Cure too much and they're really depressed. It's like, stop listening to The Cure. That'll help.
Yeah. So when did it get to a point where it became, you know, like you said, you were high functioning. Did it ever get to a point where unmanageable, or did you hit some type of rock bottom, or?
I did hit a rock bottom, but I learned how to function in the fact of, a lot of times I had this job when I was in college where I worked at a camera shop, which all photographers do at one point or another, and we just blow a bong first thing in the morning, and it's like that would just get me through the first hour or two. I moved back to Grand Rapids and started working for a newspaper, and would go drinking after work every night, and it just got to the point where it just got more and more. I just was doing it all the time, and I know from people in my family, I won't go too deeply into my family stuff because I don't, they have their own privacy, but some members of my family used to do the same thing. They'd just get drunk every night and just sort of go into this very sort of weepy space. And I was starting to do that, and I would go home almost every night and get drunk by myself and like cry myself to sleep and things like that. And it just got to the point where I was about ready to go nuts. I was literally, I thought I was going to go insane. So, and I got to a point where, actually I was going to visit. I was just a wreck emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And I had a friend who was living in Ohio, and we were going to meet in Ann Arbor, Michigan, like halfway, a friend from college. And actually, I remember riding down the interstate and listening to a David Bowie song, Rock and Roll Suicide. And for the first time in my life, I actually understood the song, and I could understand killing myself. And this was actually really the first time that idea gained traction. And one part of me liked it, and the other part of me was like, no, this is too far. There's like a part of my insides were like, no, 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 no. And so I had this huge conflict. And when I met my friend, she was somebody I knew from Madison, and in the first few minutes, once we sat down, we're in the quadrangle in Ann Arbor there, and I just started crying and opening up to her. And that was my overcoming of denial. Denial is a weird thing. You don't know what denial is until you are out of it. So intellectually, mm-hmm. I understood that I was a drunk, but knowing it in your heart that you've got this, that this is really destroying me, that opened up there. And mm-hmm. that very next day, I went to my first AA meeting.
Yeah, because it's like, basically, I mean, when you start getting into recovery, it's almost like that's the first step of not lying anymore, really. You know?
Yes.
Like you're okay, I'm going to be honest here.
Yes. And it's being honest with yourself, right? And also about denial is you can't see it. You can't see it because there's a thing in your brain that's like, no, we're not going there. No matter what, we're not going there. And so when that wall crashes down, the bricks come with it. So, go ahead.
What was I've read, I was also in a phase of just after I got sober of just binge reading, probably not the best word, but binge reading addiction memoirs. Binge reading addiction memoirs, you know, and I would always I want to hear people's stories, but people always kind of left out what it was really like being sober, like in early sobriety, because people always say, like, oh yeah, it was bad and then I'm so great now. But a lot of people who especially are looking, you know, to get sober or getting help, they want to know, like, what is it like? Like when you first start getting honest with yourself.
It sucks. It sucks.
Tell us what you really mean.
No, really, it does. It sucks wholeheartedly because this is, the rock bottom of my life. Okay. So it was like the very first day I went to an AA meeting, it was like just to push open that door. The doors of that building were the heaviest of my life. And I was an emotional wreck. I was just on the inside, I was this combination of numb and. Let me put it this way. It's like my heart was this, you know, when you're a kid and you scrape your knees and then you pick at the scab. It's like, imagine your heart is covered with this stuff and you picked all the scabs off of your heart. And that's what's inside of you.
Okay. Totally raw.
Totally raw. But also you're like filled with shame and disgust with yourself. And like, I'm just this wretched, horrible being. And I just really, really this combination of hating myself, but knowing I didn't want to go down the other path. It's like I was falling in the darkness down the abyss and I slammed hard down on a cliff on the way. And I looked down over the abyss. It's just more darkness. I didn't want to go down there. So it's like this, like rolling over in the gutter and then like clawing your way up this wall when you're exhausted and you're covered with scabs and sores. That's what it felt like. So in those days, AA meetings, you had to have this, like, there were these just gigantic ashtrays with mountains of cigarette butts. And then you're starting to go into this, you know, drinking, gallons of standard American rot gut coffee, you know, and you're kind of shaking. I don't know if the shakes were the DTs or it's just the coffee and the nicotine. And, cause that was what I was kind of living on. And every day was just a struggle just to get up. One of the things actually that was going on at that time that gave me a reason to wake up is I was going to this karate class, and I liked the teacher. He's this little Polish American guy. He's really quite a salty dude. But the only reason I just woke up because I wanted to go to the karate class. That was the one thing in my life that was, I felt was constructive. Also, part of what my work was as a photojournalist is I got to see a lot of stuff that we really don't want to see. People doing horrible things to each other. What happens if you don't, you know, fasten your seatbelt, that kind of stuff. So that was always the most exciting, you know, it wasn't the thing. I wasn't really keen on working at that time, but I still did.
Mm-hmm. I'm Catherine Artsimas, and you're listening to Coming Clean Radio, The Art of Transparency. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Paul Krauss will talk further about his story and also the personal development work that he does. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for a radical shift in your way of being? Are you seeking a more deeply connected and fulfilling life? Awakened Living Radio is a show dedicated to helping you embrace a life filled with profound peace, connection, and happiness. TJ Woodward is passionate about helping you find your clarity, balance, and purpose. Join co-host TJ Woodward and Dr. Pat Basile on the first Monday of every month at 11 a.m. Pacific Time for Awakened Living Radio on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Get ready to rid yourself of all that is weighing you down and holding you back. Coming Clean, The Art of Transparency with Catherine Moss is a hit show that brings a real and dynamic message to uncovering and believing in the true amazing being you already are. Tune in and let Catherine help you become truthful, authentic, and mindful of living on purpose one day at a time. Live each Tuesday, 9 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Tune in to Lucid Planet Radio with Dr. Kelly Neff. This hit show will illuminate your senses and empower you beyond your daily stressors and hardships. Renowned psychologist and author Dr. Kelly will captivate you with far-reaching topics and amazing guests as you wake to the greatest version of yourself. Learn to tap into your intuitions, think critically about our world, heal emotional and psychological wounds, and follow your passions to live your dreams. The Lucid Planet. Welcome home. Visit lucidplanetradio.com for more information.
Are you ready to stop stress, anxiety, and low self-esteem from running your life? Join award-winning author Dr. Friedemann Schaub for Empowerment Radio and learn breakthrough solutions to switch out of survival mode and approach every day with great ease, joy, and purpose. Tune in the first and third Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific to Empowerment Radio with host Dr. Friedemann Schaub on Transformation Talk Radio. Visit the fearandanxietysolution.com to learn more.
Almost everyone at some time in their lives ask themselves, what am I? Most of our questions are ego-generated and simply don't address the problem of our false self. It's time to relax your ego and embody your soul. Dr. Dan Cohen, neurologist, inventor, and author, has created tools to awaken, a new way to transform from who you thought you were into what you truly are. Visit toolstoawaken.com today.
What if we really didn't have to die to go to heaven? Are you curious about the afterlife or rebirth? The highly anticipated new book from author Dr. Susan Allison, You Don't Have to Die to Go to Heaven, is available now. Find out how to find guidance and healing in the spirit realms. Order the book today and put it on your must-read list for 2016. Visit drsusanallison.com to learn more.
We're back on Coming Clean with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
I'm sorry.
With myself, Catherine Arzimas. I have Paul Krauss here telling his story of recovery and the work that he does as a personal development consultant. What were you going to say?
Nothing. That's okay. Sorry.
Okay. No, I just wanted to, before we continue with your early sobriety experience, could you share your contact information with the listeners just so people know how to contact you?
Right. The easiest way is to contact me through my website, which is paulkrause.com. Krause is spelled C-R-O-U-S-E. And you literally can go to tootallpaul.com. That was one of my nicknames when I was in college. Too tall, like I'm 6'5" or almost 2 meters tall. So tootallpaul.com. If you go to that, that'll take you to the paulkrause.com. I was really amazed at that. URL actually still existed. I was searching
Too Tall Paul.
Yeah. I was, wow, it's still there. I bought it instantly. So that's, if you go to my website and there'll be a contact, it says contact, or you can just put Paul Krause, P-A-U-L Krause, C-R-O-U-S-E into Google. I'm usually like second on the list. I'm not the used car salesman and I'm not the guy with the felony insurance conviction.
Okay, good to know.
That's not me. That's a different Paul Krause. So,
and you, so on your, you, have, we'll go into, you know, your work that you do, but on your website, you have a, you do posts like blog, blog, and you also have a radio show.
Yes.
Right.
I do.
Yeah, and I was actually just reading one of your blog posts. The crying in Stockholm is so beautiful.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
So well written. So the blog posts, I would definitely recommend anyone checking them out.
Great. Thank you.
Very, very insightful and beautiful.
Thanks.
So within early sobriety, how did you make the jump then to, you decided that you didn't want to be in that area anymore. You didn't want to be around those surroundings. So you made this, you made the jump to move.
Yeah, well, it took me a couple of years. I went to sobriety and started going to AA meetings, which I highly suggest. I mean, people can have criticisms of AA, that's fine. But if someone needs, that's the best place to land, all right? And if somebody's having an alcohol problem, if they're listening to this right now, just Google AA meetings and get your butt to that meeting. Just go as soon as you can. And if people are having problems with someone, like their partner or their family member has alcohol problems, go to Al-Anon meetings. And Al-Anon meetings are people for, like, family members of or other people that are dealing with alcoholics, because you really do need a support system. It's something you really can't do on your own. There are other kinds of ways of doing alcohol recovery, but I think that's the first place to land. It's a very good place to go. I want to stress that with people. And if you don't feel comfortable, maybe ask a friend who's sober to take you mm-hmm. to one of these meetings or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's really making that step. And doing it right away. Don't think about it, because your mind will mess you up. The mind will think of a bazillion reasons not to do it.
Yeah, totally.
So then I went and did this, I did this outpatient rehab thing, and I got sobered out. And make a long story short, there was a person. So I worked for a newspaper, and I'd been trying a couple of years to get a job in a different city, and that business, well, now it's all dead, but in those days, news photographer, it's like if one job opened, you'd get like 1,000 people applying for it. So it was impossible to get another job. And there was a woman, this British woman, who was an intern at our newspaper, and we became close friends, and she was British. She was going to school at San Francisco State, and we became close friends, and she finally said to me, "You have to get out of this town." And she told me that she goes, "Well, look, you're a native English speaker, and you have a university degree. You can get a job traveling the world as an English teacher." And I'm like, "Really? I didn't know that." She goes, "Yes, English is the international language." I'm like, "Wow." Make a long story short, she connected me. She had a cousin who was working in Osaka as an English teacher, and her cousin said, "Sure, I'll help you out." So I sold all my stuff, got a backpack, got a plane ticket, came to Japan. The day I quit my job was actually the day of the Kobe earthquake. And Kobe is a city that's attached to Metro Osaka. It's on the other side of Osaka from Kyoto. But I still came to Japan anyway. And it was one of the best things I've ever done. A lot of people were saying, "No, don't do it. Don't." My dad was like, don't go. It's not safe." And the woman was like, "Yeah, sure. It's fine. I mean, if you're right in the middle of where the worst of the earthquake zone is, that's not a good idea. But the rest of the whole metropolis of Osaka, Kyoto, Kobe, it was only a very relatively focused area that the extreme damage was. So I just stayed away from there." Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up in Japan. And it took me a while, and I found a job in Kyoto City. And that's what worked for me was how do I say this? When I first came to Japan, the first job I was trying to get didn't work, and a whole bunch of things didn't work, and I was getting a little frustrated by it. But once I got in the right place at the right time, it's like the doors opened up for me, and everything happened like boom, 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 boom. I kind of believe that when you're on your right path, the universe just opens the doors for you and says, "Here, take it, take it." But you got to take it. Because a lot of people are like, "I don't know if I should do this." It's like, you know, when the door, because the windows of opportunity open and then they close. So
and you're like, okay. And so you went over there, you were teaching English, and now these days you're a personal development consultant. So how did you start to realize that you were the gifts that you had to help other people?
Well, part of it started out with my becoming sober in Michigan. I started realizing I pursued, How do I say this? I had some, let's say I had some difficulties with the AA model. I won't go into so much detail about that. It just didn't seem to jive with me. And I pursued some other ways of doing internal work. And many of them were spiritual in origin. There's a woman in Grand Rapids, a woman I work with. Her name is Denise Iwani, and she's part of the Star Nations Radio. She's one of the founders of it. And she's amongst other things, she's a full-on psychic, and she encouraged me a lot and pointed me on the pathway of doing my inner work. And I also pursued other avenues of inner worth along spiritual realms. And then I learned along the way that I have a special gift of just knowing stuff about people. And it's, a lot of people freak out with like the clairvoyance or whatever. For me, what it works is it comes through my heart as opposed to my head. So I can kind of feel stuff about people and just know things. Now, a lot of people want to go to a psychic or a fortune teller to have them tell them what to do. And that's not what I do. From what I do with people is, they come to me for help, and I teach them tools, things like mindfulness, teach them how to meditate. Meditation is like, I think, one of the best things that someone can do for just sort of clearing your mind out and centering yourself. And there's other techniques that I teach also, but I try to point them on the right path, but that they figure it out. Because when you tell someone to do something, they're like, yeah. But when you figure it out yourself, then it really drives it home. And when I was working as an English teacher here in Japan, I learned that very well, how to do that with people, someone teaching them a foreign language. But here I applied those techniques I learned as a teacher with the people I'm working with. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that explains much, if I said that well.
So would you consider yourself a coach?
One of the things I do is coach people, but I also, I've been having a difficult time how to describe what it is that I do. Cause a lot of people are like, it's not easy to describe what it is that you do. Part of it, what I do is coaching, but part of what I do is spiritual teaching. And I teach people awareness and technique and spiritual, that word has a, it's kind of a, there's a lot of baggage with that word. I mean, because there's, you know, there's images of like the TV preachers on here, sing praise, hallelujah, send your credit card number here today. You know, there's that, or there's like, you know, some, you know, faux Indian guru in California that's, you know, here, you know, put this necklace on and this yogi pose, which is perfectly fine. I mean, some of this is cultural, you know, not everybody, you know, I used to live in the North Woods of Wisconsin. So the certain cultural things I have don't work with sort of the California way of doing things. And that's perfectly fine. Midwesterners tend to be a bit more down homey.
Western sensibilities.
Yeah. It's like, you know,
like, so how, I think that this is something that you portray very well. Like when I was watching some of your videos, you know, when you were talking about what you do, that, like remaining, being, you know, being in connection with, you know, spiritual self, that we are spiritual, but we're grounded, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, how do you do that? Like, how can, you know, be in touch? Because I think when a lot of people think like, oh, you know, it's like you, when we were in Kyoto, you told me a YouTube channel or show to watch. It was guy who was like, I'm uber spiritual.
Yeah. This uber spiritual guy.
What's it called again?
Oh, I'm uber spiritual guy. He's really funny. He's like,
yeah,
the
so
most...
if you Google uber spiritual guy, he just made like a few, it's like, they're like parodies of, just, you know,
what I call new age junkies.
New age junkies.
So they, okay. Yeah, people just like take the surface of it too much, but don't really understand what the core of it. The core of what I believe and teach people is, look, you got a spirit, you got to deal with it. And your spirit, I'll use the regular word. I try to speak regular English. You got a soul. Okay. And this is the thing that you bring into the world. Like when a baby is born, they've got their whole personality is right there. Their whole sense of being. I believe that we come through many lifetimes, but you don't have to believe that. But your soul is there and it needs nourishment. It needs daily care and feeding. It also needs healing. So one of the things that I'd learned when I sobered out was there were stuff from my childhood that I hadn't been dealing with, that I kept buried. And there's some stuff that I didn't even know about. Again, I won't go into detail about that part of my personal life, but it was something that I was using the drugs and alcohol to cover up. And so I had this numbness inside because I didn't want to feel these things. And ultimately, with a lot of psychological stuff, things really do come back to when you were childhood, and we carry it through our lives. Things from when we're like 2 years old, when our ego was just forming. So this pain, and we're not really taught, oftentimes not taught how to deal with these pains. Spiritual practices are part of a way of dealing with these feelings and dealing with our thoughts and dealing with this, why was I born? Why am I here? Why am I in so much pain? We all have pain. There's all dark and there's all light, but how do you deal with it? We live in a materialist society, a materialist age where we're bombarded day and night with advertising that just wants us to buy stuff. And even if you try to get away from it, we're still being brainwashed by we have to buy stuff and we have to be consumers and we have to. Well, advertising works by making you feel like crap. It makes you feel depressed. And the idea is you feel bad, but if you buy the product, you'll be happy. Well, the thing on the outside doesn't bring true happiness. Sure, it's nice to have money. People are always saying, oh, money isn't important. Well, when you don't got any, it's important. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have money to survive in the world. But if that's your end all and be all, you're going to be miserable because that the newest iPad or the new car, or the new house is not going to give you lasting happiness. It's not going to be, you know, am I just on this planet just to buy stuff? I think no. And am I just on this planet to describe how bad it is? No. I think that we all of us have a reason that we were born, and part of the spiritual path is to figure that out. And also part of the spiritual path is to fall down flat on our faces and get scraped noses and to go through the difficult times. Because when you go through the difficult times and you come out the other end stronger, able to deal with what life has to throw at us. Because life isn't fair. We have to make the fairness. Mm-hmm. We have to make the meaning of our life and find it. And these are not things that necessarily come through science. Now, I'm not attacking the science and the scientific method, but that is one way of exploring the universe. But another way of exploring the universe is to go your inner universe and your heart. And that's why things like poetry or music, you know, people can relate to musical lyrics. Like there was the David Bowie song that just connected with me in a way that nothing else could have. It's a song I'd heard hundreds of times before, but I finally understood what he was saying about being suicidal. That's, I think, is kind of catching onto the spiritual realm of things. Spiritual is difficult to describe what it is, but it has to do with our existence, and it has to do with all of us together. Now, people get all hung up on, you know, my God's better than your God, or their dogma or their ideology, and I'm really not into that. And actually, I've helped people get out of groups that were very, you know, cultish groups that are trying to control people. But that you find the thing, you know, there's these old ancient teachers that that, you know, understood stuff in ways that most of us can't. And you can follow these teachers and apply these ideas into the modern world. But it doesn't have to be an ancient teacher. You don't have to read the old Zen texts. God, I can't speak English in one. So even Reverend Taka said, the Zen Buddhist priest that you met, a lot of people don't read the ancient Chinese Zen Buddhist texts. It's not applicable to this modern age, you know. No, go ahead.
Like what you said with, I don't think that, at least in my experience, that we're brought up and we learn to develop ourselves and take care of ourselves. Like, you know, we take care of our bodies, but we don't really, the spiritual aspect is never brought into it. We're not brought up learning that that's something that we need to take care of.
And if people are, many times they're brought up in a religion that they sort of end up rejecting with a lot of people. Now, some people don't. Some people are brought up with a religion and it works for them. And that's great. If it works for them, excellent. Because the thing about religion is it does give a framework with which to understand the universe around them and to the world. Some people will go off, oh, well, it's just superstition. It's like, yeah, but these people are happy and have a great life and they take care of their families well and they contribute to society. Why criticize them for that? You know, if they have a belief system that's different than yours, that's great. But when, you know, there's also the thing where people are trying to thunk it over your head, then, mm-hmm. Well, you know, you get into politics. Politics is a contact sport. So, you know,
these days it is.
Always has been.
So for people who maybe don't understand or have never worked with someone who is, you know, with self-development and coaching, can you explain maybe like what the benefits would be? Because some people I think have been like, okay, well, you know, I have friends that I can talk to that I work my problems out with. Like, what are the kinds of things that you can help people, solve and work through? And
okay. Well, with some people, firstly, I got to find out where the person is at. So we usually meet them and talk with them. I usually work on via Skype or face to face.
Somebody could travel to Kyoto
and we can talk. And some people I help in one session. A lot of people know what they need to do, but they're kind of afraid to do it. Most people already know their answer, but they're afraid to say it out loud for one reason or another. So I've helped a lot of people in just one session. So for example, in here in Kyoto or in Japan, a lot of people, the expats are like, should I stay or should I go? And usually when they're having that conversation, they want to go and they're looking for some sort of way of rationalizing it. Usually I just talk with the person and find out what their deal is and ask them questions. And it's actually quite simple. It isn't particularly spiritual. It's just sort of like, well, walk through logic with them. Other people have maybe old wounds or whatever. And that's part of what I do when I work with people is to teach them, give them skills. And part of it is, for example, I start with meditation, teach people to meditate every day. One gentleman I work with, he had been an alcoholic and then he sobered out and then he was having anxiety problems and they, you know, the doctors put him on these drugs, which numbed him out. So he numbed himself out with the drinking and then he numbed himself out with the legal pharmaceuticals. And then he wanted to get off the pharmaceuticals and he got off of them and he wanted to learn how to deal with his feelings again. And so I started out with meditation and including always and doing techniques where you come back to your body, come back to the present moment. And then we worked on very specific ways of, we have a lot of conditioned thinking and to stop ours, to catch ourselves if we have, as they say in AA, stinking thinking. So very specific things. It's not like a psychologist would tend to think about what a psychologist, I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a counselor, so I have to be clear about that. But there are a lot of times focusing a lot on the past, I'm screwed up because of A, B, and C. And my theory is you're not screwed up. You're a human being who's reacted to being alive. And this is where you are today because of the sum total of everything you've ever done in the past. And you need to make, and you can make choices. Choice is one of the most important spiritual things, is you choose to do things. So if we're running on autopilot, like being an addict, we have to have something. We're not in control of ourselves. Well, we're not making choices. We're like we're being a slave. Are we a slave to our mind as we that sugar we got to shove in our mouth? Are we a slave to whenever my wife says something, I bark at her because of this conditioned response, because of the way my, you know, brother barked at me when we were kids or whatever. So learning to not be a slave to our conditioned thinking, but being able to stop for just a moment to make choices. Everything becomes a choice. And to do that, we need to be in the present moment and be aware of what's going on around us, because life is here. The Zen thing is, look at the world the way that it is, not the way that you want to be, but be awake, be here. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you got to slap yourself in the face to bring yourself back to this present moment. Do it, because you want to be fully in your body. You want to be fully, if it hurts, that's great. It means you're soul. Now, there's ways of, now pain can be, you know, dealing with pain is a very difficult thing. Some people have chronic pain and, you know, there are specific techniques with it. But part of it is just being aware. So it's making changes in daily, you know, incremental changes into daily life. But coming from a place of, from your heart, from your innermost self and not the mind. We have to deal with the mind, but you are not your mind. You're more than that. So the benefits can be, later it's like, I'm not controlled by my mind. I'm not controlled by this food. I may still have cravings, but I've learned a way of dealing with those cravings. For example, I'm not, as argumentative, or I'm just, you find times of actually having moments where you're happy, just being happy of just being, you know, because some people are just never happy. They don't even know how to feel happy. That can help make changes in our life as sort of like a water rushing down the river. Okay. I don't know if explained it well or not.
That's perfect. I think it was really, really clear. How can people reach you again?
They can reach me at my website, which is paulkrause.com, C-R-O-U-S-E, or tootallpaul, T-O-O, tootallpaul.com. That's right, tootallpaul.com. Operators are not standing by. That's my top 40 radio voice.
And then I like that voice.
We could do it again.
Okay, well.
Jazz radio voice.
I know sometimes I want to like just start the show in that voice. I'm like, welcome to Coming Clean. I thank you. Thank you, Paul, for coming on and sharing your story and also the work that you do.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be on your show, and good luck with this. Again, it was a pleasure meeting you, and you know, it's good to be alive today, and it's good to be awake and aware and sober today. So, thank you very much for this.
Yeah, I had a great time. I hope you enjoyed yourself as well.
I did.
So please join me every Tuesday at 12 Eastern, 11 Central, and 9 a.m. Pacific time. Next week, on Coming Clean, I will have Laura Silverman from the Sobriety Collective on the show. So have a great week, and I'll see you back here next time. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Coming Clean, The Art of Transparency with Catherine Moss. Catherine can help you rid yourself of that which is weighing you down and holding you back from living the life you envision. Let's become truthful, authentic, and mindful of living on purpose one day at a time. Tune in each Tuesday, 9 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com or visit the archives at withintheflow.com.